Well, hello, Holly.
Hi, Dave.
What's going on?
Hey, welcome, everybody, all of you, to What Difference Does It Make?
Yes, all of you, meaning you're probably listening by yourself, right? Do you listen to podcasts by yourself?
Right, it's not a group listening experience.
Although it'd be fun.
No.
Everyone gather around the
It's a podcast listening party?
Sure. We're going to have to do that. When's our next... We're going to have a podcast listening party.
Yes. Come one, come all.
All right. Our first person that we would invite is our person...
Our guest! We have a guest!
We do have a guest. All right, Holly, this is your guest, so take the lead, please.
I am so excited. This is our guest, but I am so excited to have J.C. Douglas. J.C. Douglas is one third of the morning show on C100 in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
But he has a long and storied career.
Mm, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Can I talk about your long and storied career, or would you like to talk about your long and storied career?
No, you go ahead. I'm going to enjoy listening to it.
All right. Set the base, and then we'll have J.C. Can we call you J.C.?
Yeah, that's good. Sure.
I mean, that was in the...
As opposed to Mr. Douglas?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Okay. You were out for a long time at Q104 in Halifax, 27 mm-hmm. years?
Yep.
And you were the program director?
For 14 of them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, where is Halifax?
Where the hell is Halifax?
Can you point it out on a map?
Why
don't you bring a map?
Sorry, that's Bangladesh.
Right, as far right as I can go. I don't even know what time zone is that in.
It's got its own little time zone that you don't know about. It's one to the east of Eastern Time. It's called Atlantic Time.
I know you're 4 hours away. That's what makes it so difficult.
It's the same time zone as Rio de Janeiro.
Ah, convenient.
When my baby.
And the same mindset.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Okay,
so.
So 14 years as program director?
Yeah. It's in Nova Scotia, which is a little, almost an island off the east coast of Canada. And we're the far eastern part of Canada, which is often forgotten by the central and western parts of Canada. But we're out there. And Q104 in Halifax as a rock station that, you know, it kind of came about in the early 80s. You know, trailing behind the trends of the world, but finally they had their own rock station as of the early 80s, and it proliferated. Rock stations proliferated from there, but it was able to be influential in its hub of maritime Canadian provinces, like four Canadian provinces there. So,
and you started out as a jock?
As a disc jockey and became program director and spent a little time.
Did you do the overnights to start out? Or
I did, yeah, back in the days when there were overnight shows. Are there even overnight shows in L.A. anymore?
No, not at all.
Not many, anyway.
Well, nah, that's I don't for sure. think so.
Because where do people get their start now?
Exactly.
So
well,
you're,
they
what
tend
was your...
to start in promotional street yes. teams now. But, I mean, yes. on air, you want to work on your craft for hours every day. So overnight shows were great. Yeah. Worked my way up.
Let's talk about some of that craft, overnight craft that you developed.
Oh, my God. Overnights were amazing. I mean, I only did them for like a few months because I was doing weekend evenings and working in the production department. But overnights were the time when it was only drunk people on the phone and you could just kind of have fun doing whatever you wanted to do, especially in a station that was kind of free-formish for its day in the mid-80s still. Kind of one of the last of that. I mean, there weren't, you know, many stations even in L.A. Maybe KLOS had a little taste of that.
And well, back in the day, KMET.
Yeah.
Back in the day. Yeah, but by the mid-80s, I mean, formats had pretty much taken over everywhere. There wasn't much left in New York either. Yeah, so we were kind of just getting that out of our systems in the mid-80s, which we'd never had a chance to broadcast in that part of the world.
Well, that's a fun time to start, like in mid-80s.
Yeah.
That's when your career launched. Was it always radio?
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, from the earliest.
You took a break,
childhood.
Didn't you? You took a break from radio.
Oh, I just thought you meant from like me.
Oh, we always madly in love with radio.
Yeah, madly in love with radio. Yeah, I took a quick break a year and a bit and hosted a television show in Halifax, and then I went back as program director of Q104.
Because TV's going down the dumpers.
There's no future there. Yeah, they're really, it's
radio.
Debatable whether there is
radio.
A future there. Yeah. And then eventually I left to go back on the air, worked at a classic hit station. And then I got an offer from C100, which was Q104's longtime nemesis, and went there to do the morning show about 5 years ago.
And it's been all...
Roses.
All roses.
Yeah, it's been great. Actually, in the market, we're second to Q104 at this point. We had built Q104 into this behemoth of a number one station, so now we're trying to chisel away as the opposition to it.
But, is it still a rock station,
Q104? It is. It's been a rock station from day one, yeah. And C100's kind of been an adult contemporary station, kind of an adult top 40 station. And at one point, it was more of a lighter album rock station up against Q104's heavier album rock thing. So now we're an adult top 40, and it's a different experience for me.
So, okay, talking about music, we were talking a little bit off pre-podcast. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious what your personal preference for music is.
It's funny, because, you know, we were talking about our graduation year, and if you graduated from high school in 83, 84, of course, that's your era of glory, right?
Yep.
Always.
As we know, we are...
84 was the best year, right?
83 was the best year.
No.
Come on. 83 for sure.
What?
See?
All right.
Two to one. You're outnumbered. It's not 2 to 3, it's 2 to 1.
Oh my God, I'm bad at math.
And there's tons of 80s music that I love, of course. I mean, I was going to all the concerts and I was in Ontario at the time in my formative years. So I saw a lot of concerts and great concerts in Toronto. That's where concerts stopped in Canada. They didn't go any further east than Toronto. So we didn't see, Montreal. But we didn't see, all the great ones down east. Over time, we eventually got them. I was totally into the music scene, of course, of the day. But I also was taking a good long look backwards and... had some influences leading me towards the 60s and 70s and kind of catching up on what I'd missed from my childhood when I was forced to listen to the Bay City Rollers records and stuff like that by my sister.
No one is forced to listen to them. People listen to the Bay City Rollers by choosing. That was my first concert.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, I'm right there with it.
I met Les McEwen at a gig at the casino down in Nova Scotia a few years ago. Hung out backstage with him. He was fabulous. Hung out backstage with David Cassidy, too, which was really kind of cool. He was very nice. I'd heard he could not be so wonderful, but he was very charming. And of course, my sister was also a big... Donny Osmond fan. So, you know, all the influencers of the older sister.
Sorry, that was actually my first album. I think I was 7, Donny Osmond Superstar.
All right.
Yes. So, yes, we are of the same, of the same era.
I'm assuming all this will be edited out.
We have to redo our entire podcast because this whole series, you've been saying that the Bay City Rollers was your first show.
The Bay City Rollers was my first show. Donny Osmond Superstar was my first album.
Okay.
Okay. Just to clarify.
All right.
I'm not familiar with the Superstar album, but...
Okay. So, first album. Let's go with that. What was your first album
that
you bought?
That I ever bought?
Yeah.
I think it was... God, I hate saying this, but I think it was Foreigner's Double Vision album.
That is a great album.
Why would you hate saying that?
No, it is a good album. And, their first two albums, I thought were, even in retrospect, they're slightly cheesy, but there's some really good... As a matter of fact... There's a great love song on the Double Vision album that never got any radio play that I sang at a friend's wedding one time.
Love is taking its toll.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Everything.
Never knew a man could be so lonely. And love could treat a man so... Life could treat a man so wrong. But when the odds were all against me, you gave me the strength to carry on. Edit that out.
Nope.
No chance.
That's going in. My radio memory of Double Vision is I actually won tickets. That was my second concert.
Seriously?
I won tickets to see Foreigner with Walter Egan at the Forum.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And my dad took me. And that was quite an experience. I went and I had to go to the bathroom, and I experienced. You know, I was like 12 years old. Like, oh my God, there's a lot of it's really smoky in
this.
Yeah, what's going on? And this is crazy. Why do I feel funny? What's going on?
Hey, now, Dad.
It was in L.A. So did Stevie Nicks show up to sing background on Walter Egan stuff?
That would have been great. No, all I remember about Walter Egan is whoever was the backup singers. They were on roller skates. This was totally sad. They were on roller skates, like roller skating back and forth on the stage. That's my awesome Walter Egan memory.
That is 70s. You might have remembered if Stevie Nicks had shown up.
I probably would have remembered that. But yeah. So anyway, I did. I was, you know, caller 20 and I won tickets.
That's fantastic. I have the claim to fame of being probably one of very few people who've won a radio contest while on the air at another radio station.
Okay, so this is a good prank.
Okay, so I was in college at Fanshawe College in London, Ontario, Canada, and we had a 3,000-watt FM radio station there, which was pretty good in 1983 for college radio. Mm. And it was a community station, and so we had to be responsible adults on the station. And CJBK, one of the local top 40 stations at the time, was doing a contest giving away... IQ 2000 rock trivia. and you had to answer a trivia question. And the trivia question was, what live song did Paul McCartney take to number one in 1977? Something like that. And I just thought, oh, God, that had to be, if there was one, it had to be a song from his debut album that he did live on Wings Over America.
Like Maybe I'm Amazed.
Maybe I'm Amazed. And that was the correct answer. So I called up the radio station. I got through, told them, and I won the prize. And I was the disc jockey on this college radio station at the moment that this happened.
So let me ask you, why were you listening to CJBK while you were on the air?
Somebody busted into the control room and said, hey, does anybody know what live McCartney song was number one in 1977?
And you stole his ticket.
Stole his thunder, his game, but I earned it. The way I figured
you did.
So I'm wondering why anybody who was working at the college radio station at the time was actually listening to another station.
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
God, I should have been on the ball there.
Sorry, I could have had going off track.
Wow.
I could have had him tossed.
Taking his prize away.
Yeah. Oh, congratulations, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. The guy's a winner. Why are you shooting him down?
You're right.
It's funny because I was, my first radio gig was a small market in Nova Scotia. And I used to listen to Q104 in Halifax when I was working at this. And I would take part in their on-air contests and all kind of using a different name. And when I went to work at Q104 the very first day, I went to work in the big city of Halifax. I stopped at the front desk and picked up a number of different prizes that I'd won. I had to collect them.
Amazing.
Mostly albums.
Good. Stickers.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Toronto and then you went to college in Nova Scotia?
Or? Yeah. I was from Nova Scotia. I lived in Ontario for a bit and then went back to Nova Scotia as an adult.
Back home.
Yep.
You have the small town vibe.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
It's not a small town. It is not a small town.
Well, Halifax? Oh, yeah. 400,000 people. It's
not a small town. I mean, it's a
all right.
mid-sized
It's as big as Nova Scotia has. That's the best we can do.
Yeah. Okay, wait.
Every time he says Nova Scotia, I think of locks. So how is the salmon?
Yes, that's right. That's funny because
that's all I know about Nova Scotia.
I was telling somebody that, just on this trip out to California, because you'll see on the menus, especially in New York City, it's like Nova Scotia locks everywhere you go. It's like, we don't call them that. I didn't know that's where
what
they
do you call
came
it?
From. Well, locks. Salmon, I guess, yeah. Smoked salmon. I don't know. We just never hear that term. It's like the same as in, I'm sure they don't call them French fries in France.
That's true.
Yeah.
What is the fishing industry like? Or is that the...
It's still booming, I think.
Okay.
Yeah,
you think? You haven't gone on...
It's not really my...
That sounds like a good radio promotion.
I'm in the music biz. But there's lots of fishing boats and lots of lobster traps and stuff like that. And there's plenty of beautiful big granite rocks and things and lighthouses and stuff. And that's what you come to see in Nova Scotia. So come on out and
fish.
See it. I'm doing a tourism bureau commercial.
You might as well.
Mm. Going back to what you said, what makes you think when you hear Nova Scotia?
Yeah.
What do you think makes me, when I hear a song...
Carly Simon, You're So Vain.
As you know, that's one of my favorite songs of all time.
You know, I don't... What's the lyric? I'm trying to... I'm sure once you say it, I'll immediately remember it.
Flew you on a Learjet up to Nova Scotia to see the total eclipse of the sun. Which was about... You know what? There were two consecutive total eclipses visible in Nova Scotia in 71 and 72. Apparently, it was the 71... total eclipse. And I remember them. I was a kid then, still living in Nova Scotia. And that's the one, it was the 71 eclipse that made its way into the lyric for that song.
Wow.
See? Because 72 would have been too late for the recording of that's the way it says online anyway.
I'm going to believe that.
I believe you.
Sure.
It
comes from an authority right there. He was there.
From the music savant.
There you go. That's right. The idiot savant.
You got to take that out. I'm not sure if that is.
That's quite all right. Don't worry about it. Okay. Sometimes I leave it in. Sometimes I take it out. It depends on how I feel at the time.
So, but that is my, and that, I want that on the spot. Sorry. I'm pointing.
That's great.
As long as Spotify plays my favorite song.
We got to keep him singing somehow.
Is that the one you were thinking of? Is that the song you were thinking of?
That is one of my favorite songs of all time. Yes.
Yeah, Nova Scotia doesn't show up in a lot of internationally known lyrics, but it started to show up on TV shows and movies and that. And there are people I know who every time that Nova Scotia or Halifax get mentioned on a TV show or in a movie theater and they hear it, they'll stand up and applaud. You know, so we find that fun.
No, you've told me in the past some movies that have been shot there.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. No, it had quite a vibrant... movie industry for a while in the 90s and 2000s. And then the government, you know, a few years ago, the government came in, took away a tax break that cheesed everyone off and kind of reduced the amount of shooting happening down there.
That is cheesed everyone off.
That I was about to say, is such a, like a I have relatives from Michigan. They say cheesed off.
I don't think I've ever said that in my life. I'm speaking a different language for podcast territory or something. I don't know.
So you started in college radio?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the school?
Fanshawe College, London, Ontario.
Go Fighting Tigers?
Go the Falcons?
Oh, come on.
Fanshawe
was not much into the competitive sports. It really wasn't a big deal there. Maybe it is more now. Last time I was at the college a few years ago, things had really grown up, and I think they take those things more seriously now. At the time, it didn't really matter.
Give a shout out the call letters.
Oh, well, 6X FM, it's all in Canada, all the call letters begin with C, right? So 6X was CIXX FM. That was the 3000 water. And then we had a little closed circuit thing in the school called CFRL.
So, sounds like kicks to me.
It was the Rock of Fanshawe, CFRL. And we went to Chum and got the Chum in Toronto, got the big AM top 40 disc jockeys at Chum to do IDs for us. CFRL, the Rock of Fanshawe. You know,
how big is Fanshawe?
It's grown exponentially, but I really have no idea. A few thousand people, but it when I saw it last time at a reunion a few years ago, it was like, holy crap, this thing's massive now compared with what it was back then.
All right. All right, so you start.
They had a great radio program and a lot of really respected radio broadcasters.
So
in
a
Canada.
Lot of you went off to big careers from yeah.
Even in my class, as a matter of fact, you know Jeff Woods,
yeah,
who hosts. Jeff and I moved down to Nova Scotia together, coming out of Fanshawe. He took a job at Q104. I was offered the same job. And I went down to Bridgewater instead.
Did he know you were offered the same job?
Well, he was kind of being kept on the line with Q107 in Toronto right out of college. And he was being kind of courted there at the same time as he was keeping Bro Jake, one of the best known, longtime morning guys. And he was then the program director and morning guy at Q104 in Halifax. He was kind of keeping Jake waiting. Jake, meanwhile, asked me about coming. And I said, I've already accepted this other job, although I would love to. In 9 months later or 7 months later, I was there. But Jeff has become kind of internationally known for his, syndicated show, which, of course, the title would be right there on the tip of my tongue.
I know. I only know
Legends of Classic Rock. Legends
go.
Of Classic Rock. And for all kinds of specials and stuff he's done over the years, he's interviewed all the bigs in the radio business. The only one that he hasn't had, I think, that he wants to have, I interviewed. And he hates me for that.
Which was who?
Paul McCartney. So,
all right. So what do you, we talk Paul McCartney. What is the question that you, of course, everyone thinks of? I need to ask him something that he's probably, that I hope he's never heard
before.
That's never been asked before. Yeah. I'm going to be the one original interviewer who's going to say something that's just going to throw him for a loop. And your question was,
I didn't necessarily want to throw him for a loop, but I had about 2 hours to prep for this thing.
That's
a lifetime worth of preparation. But at the time, it was about a week after the death of Michael Jackson, so I was the first electronic media person to interview him since the death of Michael Jackson. So I did ask him about that, and he gave us some really interesting quotes. So we kind of parlayed that into a International Wire story. But the other thing was that I didn't want to ask him about all the women in his life, which at the time, 11 years ago, was a big deal because he had just gone through the divorce and all that, and so I thought I'd ask him instead about the men in his life, and I think the best question I asked him was, did you spend so much time with George Harrison and show him so much kindness in the last days of his life because you felt it was incumbent upon you to make up for, you know, the way your behavior around John Lennon's death was sort of misinterpreted, you know, the whole quote of, it's a drag. And he said, no, he really felt that his relationship with George was at a point where he was truly his little brother and that he cared and would do whatever he could. He said he never thought of it from the standpoint of how was he going to be perceived, you know, the way he was misperceived after John's death.
Yeah, that was a misquote too, with Paul McCartney. I mean, that was just like a pull quote. I always remember that it's a drag, but Interview, you see like the full thing, like, yeah. he was in pain.
Yeah. And I think what happened there was he was just leaving a studio, and I think he was sufficiently high that mm-hmm. he didn't really know exactly what he was saying or being asked and what was going on in the world at that moment. So he just said what came to his mind was, oh, it's a drag, man.
I gotta take a break.
You always have to take a break.
I know.
Why can't we get through this thing? One shake. All right, let's stop it. We're going to stop it right here, and we'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back. We're with J.C. Douglas.
Excellent. Let's start it up. So you start at with these humble beginnings, this overnight, and then how do you land the big time gig, this morning show? Is it a morning show, or they call it a breakfast show, or what?
Morning show. The thing is, I worked my way into the afternoon show at Q104, and I stayed there for like 11 years, and then I went off and did television for a while. Got hired back to Q104 as program director, so wanted to run the show, and I did for 14 years, and kind of got all of that out of my system, and then had to go do something. So I figured the part that I liked the most was being on the air, so I went and did afternoons at a classic hit station for a couple of years, then got the offer at the Adult Top 40 to do breakfast there with a couple of people who had been our sworn enemy at Q104, you know, so it was a really different thing. I mean, I liked them as people. They were, one of them, in fact, had come to one of my weddings and, you know, that sort of thing. but it was different doing a show with multiple people and getting to know these people who were people I'd competed against, but it's a different format.
Like Q104 is like a rock station, mm-hmm. probably like, I visualize it like a WKRP type of scenario. Well,
yeah, in many ways, it probably was in its early days, but, it was, think KLOS. really. I mean, not a lot different, at least when I heard KLOS last. But a mix of contemporary rock still. They're still playing a lot of
just male machismo type stuff, and then and then you move on
and classic rock as well in there, but and still play music of all eras from like the 60s through today.
What was your tag? What was Q?
In the early days, it was the Rock of the Atlantic, which was very cool. And today, for the last 20 years or more, it's just been classic rock, or no, not classic rock, the home of rock and roll, Q104.
Why'd they switch it? Rock of the Atlantic.
You know what? They revived that tagline for an evening network show they do out of the station in Halifax now. So they have a 5-station network show that they call the Rock of the Atlantic. Now, we always tried to revive it for different things because we all liked it.
That's the Rock
of the Atlantic.
All right. So you said get it out of your system as a PD. What were the pros and cons of being the Andy Travis of the station?
You know what? I was in the last wave of programming before social media got to the point where if you were doing anything really outrageous promotionally, that would offend, people, the moral minority, they would instantly put together a social media boycott of your sponsors. So we got to the point where we would get about 2 weeks before they'd be able to generate enough
names on the petition.
Yeah, to really get to the sponsors, and that would give us just enough time to get the promotion done. It's instant. Now, if you do something really crazy, they'll just instantly be marching into your office with placards and into the car dealerships and stuff like that.
Okay, what was one of the promotions that would have raised the ruffling of the fan?
So many that we did.
I am shocked that you would do such a thing.
Well, we borrowed from the best. I'm sure we borrowed some KLOS stuff. And there was a station out in Edmonton called The Bear that was doing a lot of really crazy stuff. I think the wildest might have been BJ, our morning guy, BJ's toughest contest, which just gave people a variety of different challenges to do for $25,000 cash prize in the end. Like, if we'd have maybe 15 people who'd qualify for the $25,000, and one of them would win it after doing one of these crazy things. It's funny because we got them to do some insane stuff, some just pretty horrible things. But the only one that I can remember somebody not being able to accomplish, like everyone would say yes to whatever you tossed at them. I mean, I even hesitate to give you an example because they're so sorted. You can edit it out if you want.
Well, remember the era too.
Well, this is we're talking about the late 2000s.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. You didn't do your Wii contest, did you?
No, that happened in California, didn't it?
Yeah.
Radio had to learn from that one.
Yeah.
Because someone died there. Drank too much water and died. Ugh. So we had to be very careful about what we did while still being as outrageous as possible. We had one of the guys give his father a prostate exam.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was awful.
And you were there for it?
I was not.
Oh, really?
And it was okay that I was a little late getting into work that morning.
Intentionally.
Only a couple did our head office say that we couldn't do. One, oddly enough, was paper cutting all of the webbing in their fingers and their toes. because apparently they didn't want us to inflict pain on anyone. They also wouldn't let us make one of our contestants drink a cup of their own pee. Go figure. But The Bear did that in Edmonton. Yeah, that was classy stuff.
Can we talk about radio and why kids don't listen to the radio anymore?
Well, listen, I'm telling you, this is, it was all underscoring the brand of outrageousness and irreverence.
The thing is, nothing of this was videotaped, right? I mean,
we did.
You did? Okay. And then where'd you, because it was late 2000. So it wasn't like, this wasn't in the,
it was all put on online to some extent.
Okay. So this was, this was,
I mean, certain things were probably pixelated.
Search
for it. Yeah. There's probably still stuff up there.
Like the prostate exam pixelated.
I would think so. It's hard to remember, but but the only thing that somebody couldn't do of all the challenges that were accepted was eat an ice cream cone full of, like a one scoop of wasabi in an hour.
Oh, yeah. It's impossible.
The person couldn't get anywhere near it. Like yeah,
gallon of milk or wasabi or the cinnamon test. Those were all things.
And frankly, if they had eaten the ice cream scoop of wasabi in an hour, they probably would have followed the person who was holding their wee into a sure death.
Good times.
Mm-hmm. So this is great stuff.
Go radio.
This has a lot to do with 80s music.
This is your life. I don't know.
Some might say this is more interesting than 80s music.
Okay.
You might.
All right.
You might.
All right. So then let's go back. Let's go. Okay. So you bought Foreigner's Double Vision.
Yeah.
Let's go to a concert. What was your first concert that you remember? Maybe with in high school or with not just with your parents going to Donny Osmond or whatever.
Yeah. I never
saw him.
Okay.
So. Now in Ontario, when I was going to college, when I was going to high school, we lived on Lake Huron. And so we were getting FM stations from across in Saginaw, Michigan, across the lake. I know the station isn't the same anymore, but 96 WHNN, the rockin' best. Yeah, that was an early rock radio influence. But a lot of we didn't get any rock concerts up that way. We had to go to Toronto, which is about a 3-mile drive.
Mm.
3-mile drive. Three-hour drive.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say.
3 whole miles. God,
yeah. 3 miles. I make a living off this.
It's Canadian miles. That's
yeah, that's right.
What's the conversion?
Yeah. 1.6 kilometers. So it was it was about 5 kilometers to Toronto. 3-hour drive. And so I think the very first big one for me was Bob Seger and Loverboy in August of 1980.
That's a good one.
It was. It was great. It was the
best of Michigan, the best of Canada right there.
That's right. That's right.
Good. That's right.
It was, and West Coast of Canada. It was the Against the Wind tour. And the first time I'd seen a couple of bigger concert. Actually, the first big concert I ever attended was in Halifax when I was there on vacation. But it was just one of those concerts on the hill, on Citadel Hill in Halifax, I was telling you about. Nice big production, but it was all local acts. So seeing Seger and this brand new band that nobody knew, but I had seen the Loverboy album on the Chum FM charts. Mm-hmm. And I heard of these guys and knew nothing about them. But so that was, August of 1980.
80. I think I may have seen them the same year. I saw them open for Journey.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where?
Might have been 79. At the Forum.
Oh,
the
cool.
When it was the Fabulous Forum.
The Fabulous Forum.
Yeah.
Right.
It's back to being the Fabulous Forum.
Yeah. Is that what they're calling it now?
Yeah, it's still the Fabulous Forum.
The Jack Kent Cook days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's converted now to, it used to, the Lakers used to play, and the Kings used to play there, but now they've converted it just to only concerts, and it's a great place to go to a show.
It's the best.
Yeah, it's really nice.
I've never been inside the Fabulous Forum, yeah. Been to the Staples Center for a hockey game. Thank you, Holly.
That's right. Who's your team? Well, you probably grew up with the Nordiques, right?
The Nordiques. The Quebec Nordiques. They joined the NHL out of the fledgling WHA in 1979, so I didn't have a early history with the Nordiques, and they've been gone since 95. They went to Phoenix, I think. They became the Phoenix, the Arizona or Phoenix Coyotes.
I'm sorry, our podcast has changed. We're now a hockey talk. Hockey talk.
We're going to talk about every subject other than 80s music. I was a Boston Bruins fan from the earliest days. My dad was in the Canadian Navy. That's why he wound up on the east coast of Canada. And they used to sail down to Puerto Rico. I think on the way they'd stop in Boston and get really cheap booze and pick up the Bruin team. On the Cape Scott, the HMCS Cape Scott back in 1967. I got photos of all the Bruins on the ship back in Bobby Orr's rookie year and stuff like that.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, so they became my team. Also, the Toronto Maple Leafs just, kind of grew up in that area. So
there you go.
They have to.
So you alluded to, there's some bleed through of American radio. Did you did you prefer American radio, or was it what were you listening to, or what was the most attractive to you?
Because the first radio station I really took notice of, other than, when we were living in Halifax and I was a child, that's the station my sister would, CJCH in Halifax would play all the Donny Osmond records and stuff like that. But when I moved to Ontario, it was just in 73, that was the, the boom time for a station called CKLW in Windsor, Detroit, Windsor, Ontario, Detroit, Michigan. And it was a legendary AM top 40 station that at night would hit, they said it hit 38 states and three Canadian provinces. And it truly was bigger than I had any awareness of when I was listening to it as a kid. But they played, they had to play Canadian content, which since 1970 was like 30% and is now 35% or 40% or whatever your particular promise of performance reads. But imagine playing in 1970, playing 30% Canadian music, especially for a very competitive top 40 station in American markets. It was a tough road to hoe, but CKLW made it work. And for, you know, most of the 70s, we're riding high in not only number one in Detroit market, but also in Cleveland. And, you know, they had a real strong audience pull and the best air personalities. And
they were CKLW, I think, of KHJ. Was absolutely. 93 KHJ.
So, and the same Johnny Mansinger's jingles and stuff. 93 KHJ, CKLW. Yeah.
Same thing. Okay. So who is the radio guy, the god that probably had like the pipes of God who talked at CKLW?
Oh my God. Brother Bill Gable.
There we go.
Who in 74, I remember my sister showing me in the back page of a Tiger Beat magazine. He was the DJ of the month. Brother Bill Gable, 1974 from CKLW, and it was like, wow, I love that guy. And
did he look like what you thought he was?
Not
look like?
In the least.
What?
That's a radio shocking. Guy.
The other thing too at CKLW is a real mix of black and white music that was unheard of and definitely on most of Canadian top 40 at the time. They were really R&B oriented as well as rock, and it was. It worked like none other had previously worked in the Detroit market. They really brought in a wide swath of listener that helped them get to number one in that market. And all the disc jockeys, with the exception of Walt Baby Love, back in the late 60s.
I worked with Walt.
I worked with Walt.
No. Oh, really?
You did too?
Oh, wow.
He was a consultant for when I did this satellite radio thing. He did. He was the R&B guy. He helped us out.
Yeah, he was at Westwood One. He was
and R&R. He worked. He wrote for R&R.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, with the exception of Walt Baby Love. Who, I mean, I just want to call him Baby Love, but you know, Baby Love, but you only ever hear it as Walt Baby Love. But he, I think, was the only black announcer they ever had at CKLW. They all sounded black, and they were all like white guys. Half of them were from Canada. Well, most of the best ones, I hate to say it, were from the States. Bill Gable was from Philadelphia, I think, and Pat Holliday. You'd know Pat Holliday. Became a big player in Canadian radio as an executive, and I've gotten to know some of these guys. I even hired Bill Gable for one of the stations that I was overseeing in Halifax to do image voice stuff, and the first time I was on the phone with him, it was like, oh my God. I was like Chris Farley in an SNL sketch. You know, I'm calling him to talk about, you know, hiring him to do voice work, and I'm like, do you remember the Big Eight? Oh my God. And and every year at CMW, I'd find myself on an elevator with alone with Pat Holliday for some reason, year after year after year, and I only just wanted to talk to him about CKLW and the glory years. And he'd look at me like, what is wrong with you, man? But no, they were great guys. And these are some of the names that I worshipped
fanboy.
Growing up. Fanboy. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so because of this 30-40% Canadian rule, were there songs that you grew up loving and then you suddenly discover nobody else knows these songs?
Well, South of the Border, that's right, yeah. Tons. Even in the early years of the 70s when the Canadian music scene or music industry had not fully developed yet, a lot of people would say, oh, it wasn't ready for prime time in 1970. And they're right. I mean, there were a few Canadian acts that would have made it on, that did make it onto American radio then at the time. The Guess Who, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, and offshoot, you know, bands of his, and Gordon Lightfoot had some, you know, these are the Canadian artists that everyone knows from back in those days. But really, it was hit and miss. But there's all kinds of little Canadian pop ditties from that era that I would know that you wouldn't know, and that I love because they have that same misty memories of any of the other cheesy pop songs of the day.
Like who, for example?
Well,
she wants you to sing some more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, geez, it won't mean anything to you if I pick the really small ones, but some of
we
them,
don't care. Just sing the
well,
song.
Some of them did, yeah.
We'll let you know if it was a hit, if it should have been a hit. That's
funny. Yes. Rate a record.
Yeah.
Some of them did bust through, like Terry Jack's Seasons in the Sun became a number one hit in the States. And he had previously had this little, he and his wife, Susan, had this poppy family thing that had some Canadian pop hits, but it was CKLW more than any other entity that made these hits in the States, because they were playing them and getting this huge listenership in the Midwest. And they would all go to their local record store and say, where's the newest Poppy Family record? And like, we don't have it. And then they'd find out, oh, you're listening to CKLW. Oh, we got it. And then they'd start shipping, you know, the American record companies became aware of the influence and started to stock the stores with some of these Canadian artists.
Canada's great gift to the United States.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Terry Jacks and the Poppy Family. Yeah. Yeah, sorry about that.
Seasons in the Sun is your responsibility.
You. Come on.
It's on you, Canada.
That's right.
Now, there are many, many great gifts, including, I know you're a fan, Dave, of some particular Canadian artists.
Well, just because
go for it.
Well, my last name is Sloan.
And oh, gee whiz. Well, there's a Halifax band.
Yeah. And I was just looking at, they just announced their tour, just an updated tour. And, you know, you see in they're touring the U.S.
Yeah.
And it's just clubs. And then they come to Canada and it's theaters, amphitheaters like these, you know, now they play the big time. But, you know, in the U.S., they just never, that was one of the bands that never happened.
Yeah, it's funny because those are great guys, and I've been, I've known them forever, because their early days were like 91, 92, and we were covering the local scene there a bit with Q104. I'd like to think that in the late 90s when I became program director, I put a much more concerted effort into covering the local scene, and it was really strong at that time. Like, we had some artists who were worthy of more airplay in various, we ended up being able to foster a few bands like, The Trues and, Winter Sleep and Matt Mays and El Torpedo and the Joel Plaskett Emergency into bands that were getting cross Canada play, but not too many of them got much, in the way of American interest.
Yeah, like the Tragically Hip was another band.
Well, see, now there's a really interesting example. There's the one that became, the Tragically Hip are gods in Canada. Mm-hmm. So much bigger than so many of the bands that you would know that are Canadian. In Canada, you couldn't touch them. And in the States, you couldn't, you know, they couldn't get arrested. It was interesting. It came down to in 94 or 95, Dan Aykroyd, said okay to SNL. He'd come and host the show for the first time. He's from Kingston, Ontario, a Tragically Hip from Kingston, Ontario. And he said, one thing that has to happen is I have to have the Tragically Hip on as my musical guest. And they said, sure, no problem. They came on the first song. They were on their fourth album, fourth full album, Day for Night at the time. And, it wasn't their strongest album. Their first three full-length albums were among the best albums ever recorded in rock history. Seriously. Mm-hmm. Like, listen to them. Go find them. Listen to them. Fully, completely, Road Apples and Up to Here. Three of the greatest rock albums you'll ever hear. New Orleans is Sinking from Up to Here is one of the best rock songs ever recorded. The fourth full album, Day for Night, was... Yeah, not quite as commercially on the money, and they played. I think they played "Greasy Jungle," the first song off that one. And it was like it's like this mid-tempo sort of thing, and it just didn't go over. And the band, I don't know if they felt much of an appreciable bump, from their appearance on Saturday Night Live. But it was, and so they never had opportunity knock at that level again. But they continued to have this incredible. Career in Canada, and Gord Downie, the lead singer, died a year or so, a little more than a year ago. And
it's like
it was like
Kobe passing, I think. It was just kind of like that. Yeah. I mean, all of Canada
really
seemed to be.
Because we knew he was sick, and he toured when he was sick with cancer, brain cancer, the same cancer that Neil Peart just died of from Rush. Another guy whose death really rocked the country. But unlike Neil Peart died very quietly and had his cancer, battled it for about 3 years. Gord Downie was anything but quiet during the time when he was battling his cancer, and he recorded some really interesting projects of his own and did a tour with Tragically Hip, and so the country just fully embraced him through this whole time, and when he finally died, it was very sad, but we knew it was coming.
I'm not familiar. I'm not so familiar with the Tragically Hip, but I do remember when he died and how it did seem like it was taken the way, like you said, Kobe or Neil Peart, which here too. I mean, I'm sure the reaction here was this, you know, the same as Canada. But.
Yeah. I was a massive Rush fan. I am a massive Rush fan.
You kind of have
to be, right? When you grow up there, it's, kind of in your blood.
I remember a kid back in high school or elementary school trying to get me to listen to Rush, and it just wasn't my cup of tea. I was more into the Bee Gees at the time, and
nothing wrong.
And then when did you get on board with Rush?
In the backseat of a muscle car that my future brother-in-law, my sister's longtime husband, was driving, and he was cranking out, you know, the Moving Pictures album, and
it wasn't a red Barchetta. You were
it wasn't a brilliant red Barchetta. As a matter of fact, I've a friend of mine who lives in St. Catharines, which is where Neil Peart is from, St. Catharines, Ontario, once took me on a tour of like a driving tour of the area, showing me the Neil Peart haunts, all to the tune of Red Barchetta. And as he goes across the one lane bridge that's referenced, he's timed it so that we're going across that bridge at the same moment, and then pulled up to the house that the white haired uncle owned and waited. And we're pulling up right in front of that house at that time. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. And also right in the area is Lakeside Park, you know, which is also a reference from an earlier Rush album. And Neil lived one door down and across the street from where my uncle and his family lived for many, many years. Not at the same time, but I always thought it was kind of cool that Neil Peart lived right there.
Yes.
Did you ever get to talk to the boys?
I did. Well, we did an interesting thing in 1986 when I was brand new at Q104 in Halifax. It's funny because I had heard the fellow who hosted our 6 o'clock rock report talking about, oh, Rush isn't coming to Halifax on this tour. And for a Canadian band, that was, and they hadn't been there since 1980. So a big 6 years since they'd last appeared in Halifax. And he said, we should start a petition or something. And I asked him, a couple weeks later, it came to mind. I said, you were talking about that petition campaign. He said, oh no, it'd be way too much work. And I talked him into doing it, and the two of us did it, and it was way too much work. And it took us a couple of months, and we raised 24,000 signatures, which probably doesn't sound like a lot, but at the time in Halifax, that was a lot.
400,000 people. That's a good percentage.
Well, and it was really genuine because we went everywhere to get these. We went to all the clubs and the schools and all over the province and in neighboring provinces. And, they agreed, we had a lot of TV, coverage out of it, national coverage and stuff like that, which you never would get today for something like that, I don't think. The band, we were in touch with their, Ray Daniels and the folks at SRO, and they agreed to start their next tour there, and they opened with a series of concerts in Atlanta, Canada. So that was very cool.
We got
to meet them and hang out backstage with them for a few hours, and it was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. Died and gone to Rush heaven. It really was amazing.
Neil engage with you at all?
A little bit, yeah. He doesn't do a lot of backstage things. Getty and Alex were much more... a few years ago in Halifax, we did another backstage, just a quick backstage thing. And Neil, of course, wasn't there for that. As a matter of fact, at the same time, a friend of mine who worked in Halifax radio with me for many years, he and his family, he's been a friend of Neil's since they met in St. Catharines when this fellow was in radio in St. Catharines a year before Neil joined Rush. And so Neil would occasionally come and visit them in Halifax and has even written about staying at their home in one of his books, one of his road books. And it's specifically about their son who has Down syndrome. And he was talking about how the son would make breakfast for him when he was staying at the place. And it would only be the two of them early in the morning getting up and having breakfast together. And so a few years ago when they played in Halifax, he had the son, who is now grown, he's in his 30s now, back to play on his practice kit. Backstage at the Halifax Metro Center.
Oh, that's great.
And there's photos of it as well. And this friend of mine, after Neil died, I'm going to get emotional. Yeah. He put photos of that up on his Facebook page that he hadn't put up before.
Yeah, it was encouraged everybody to post their photos.
Yeah. So that's Neil funny. He was a spectacular spirit, a spectacular man.
Did you read all his books?
I haven't. I've read passages of them. I haven't read them all. I want to. I'm saving that for retirement. No, yeah. I really do want to. I'd never have enough time for reading, but I'm in the middle of Keith Richards' memoir, and it's fascinating. I'm about 10 years late on that, so.
Still well, great.
You should be retired from Neil Peart. It's a little heady.
Yeah.
All right, so you were talking about being backstage. You ever do a front stage, like, hey, the band's about to come out.
All kinds.
Now, how is that? What's that like in front of, I don't know how many.
It's very 10,000. Cool.
Is it cool, or is it like, is it tough?
At its best, it can be really super cool. You know what? The two best I ever did, I can say, totally without reservation. One was Sloan.
Mm.
One was Sloan on a on a New Year's
Go
Eve.
Sloan.
Go Sloan.
On a New Year's Eve about maybe 10 years ago or so at Casino Nova Scotia. And it was just so much fun. I had prepared a little thing. I can't even remember what it was. I think I had strung together a bunch of their titles and lyrics and just did a rapid fire sort of thing. And they were loving it. And we were like old pals and stuff. And so it was really good, went over really well. The other was, it was Deep Purple at, Halifax Metro Center. And this was only about 10 years ago too. And it was on,
come on.
It was an early February show, and it was the night of the Super Bowl. And so it was a little.
It doesn't
light.
Play in Canada though. The Super Bowl.
It does.
Oh, it does. Oh, that's interesting. Big oh, time. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's pretty big. It's funny because I don't think it plays around the rest of the world as much as right. Americans might think it does. Because people, it's got this worldwide audience of 2 billion people. I think they're lucky if they got the American and the Canadian audience. I don't know how much bigger the Super Bowl is.
Embellishing those numbers.
Yeah, they could be like other things we were talking about. Yeah. But I opened, I did the show intro for, Deep Purple that night, and there were only maybe about 5,000 people at the Metro Center, which was about half its capacity. Wow. It's about a 10,000 seater. And I can't even remember what the lines were, but I had a couple, I prepared a few like really snappy lines, and they got great laughs. When you get huge laughs, even from a 5,000 person crowd, it's like, whoa. That's the rush you don't get on radio. You never get that live response, right?
But you are also, you're kind of used to being up in front of a live crowd.
A little bit. I mean, I've done like some local theater and stuff like that, but not.
Are you an actor?
A little bit of an actor, a little bit of a singer, but none of those things professionally.
You're a song and dance man?
Song and dance man.
Nice.
Would you like me to, would the podcast audience like to watch a little song and dance?
Oh, of course.
Yes.
I guess you could hear the song, but not the dance.
In particular, I think they'd appreciate the full Monty.
Oh, my God, yes, we did the full Monty.
Oh, geez.
Just okay. In the community theater.
Don't terrify me. I just met the man.
Oh. Yeah. Luckily, I was at my lightest weight at that time, by 25 pounds less than I do. And we got naked. And that was bizarre.
For a week or a month, or how long was this
run?
We
did 14 shows.
Nice.
And they were sold out.
14 days of naked.
Yeah.
They sold out the day of the opening show. So, in other words, nobody had any idea whether it would be entertaining at all before they bought a ticket. And all they knew was that there were going to be 6 middle-aged men naked on stage at some point. And really, it's only for like a minute or two when it's full nakedness.
Yes, but everybody is still, no one's taking their eyes off the stage.
Right. And of course, We the full-on naked part, we're facing the back of the stage.
Yeah.
And there's only two people who would have seen that every night. One was our assistant stage director, who was a female. The other was the bass player in the band, who was a female. And she was blind. At least at the end of the performances, she was blind.
You blinded her.
She was blind at the beginning of them. But yeah.
You blinded her.
That's a true story.
That's great. Were you a theater major in college?
No, God, no. This is just community theater. I mean, I don't know.
Hey, Jess, it's a big deal.
This is waiting for Guffman stuff, you know? Oh, this is like,
That's good stuff.
That's a good reference.
All right. There's another TV reference. I mean, we talked a little bit about blending of U.S. and Canada, but apparently you were a Letterman fan.
Oh, huge. Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well. That's funny. I just because I like to get attention, I think. When I finally went to see, I'd loved Letterman since the morning show at NBC in 1980. I remember I got a babysitting gig, and I was like 15 that summer, and I got a babysitting gig with one of the neighbors, and really I just thought, oh, this is perfect. I can make money and watch the Letterman morning show at the same time. A 90-minute show to begin with. He had Edwin Newman in the studio doing news updates, and so it was awesome. And by 95, I mean, like, he was just my biggest influence in, you know, my broadcasting career, although I'd never done TV. I later would do a little bit, but we finally decided, let's get some tickets and go see this guy. And went to the Ed Sullivan Theater, and I prepared a little, his big deal, Dave had been a weatherman in Indianapolis, as you may know. And he once described there having been hailstones the size of canned hams. So his his prop du jour was the big ass ham. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember this.
Of course.
Yeah. This was like 25 years ago. And I wanted to get my hands on a big ass ham, and I wondered, how can I do that? And so we were going to take some like doctored cans of lobster. It turned out I go to the store, the superstore in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and pick up it's like, I can't find canned lobster. Ooh. But there's canned clams, and it rhymes. This is must be it's a sign from God.
It's kismet.
It's kismet. And so I doctored the can to say big ass clams. And boy, I'm telling you, it was not easy to get that to David Letterman's attention, because the drill sergeants that were the pages that CBS had at the Ed Sullivan Theater were really hell-bent on making sure that nobody said anything to Dave, nobody gave any gifts to Dave, nothing like that happened. We had sweatshirts done up, myself and my then girlfriend, and mine said, we'll laugh real loud for canned ham. And hers said, make mine a big ass, please. And so the pages saw at one point that we had these shirts on and said, no, you can't do that. He said, oh boy. They said, no, you're going to have to take those off. I said, oh, off, but they're at a, well, turn them around anyway, or turn them inside out. And he said, or zip up your jacket. I said, oh, that I can do. I can zip up my jacket for sure. Cause we can always unzip. So in the,
these 20-year-olds are not that bright.
Oh my God. So in the,
they're pages, they're interns.
That's funny. So we're sitting there waiting for the show to begin, and we had it all worked out. Cause if you ever hear two voices yelling something together in sync, it sounds like a chorus of voice. One voice is one simple voice. It could be one madman, but two voices is like a choir. And so we had it worked out. Okay, as soon as the moment is right, and he comes out, because we figured he'd come out and talk to the audience, do a little warm-up. I said, I'm going to count 1, 2, 3. And we both jump up. And when this took place, we jumped up, unzipped the jackets, and went, let us show you our shirts! Dave looks over, mic in hand, says, what is it, sir? You know, and at that moment, I reached under the seat, into the bag where the doctored can of clams was, and started to walk towards the stage.
Alert authorities.
Oh, my God.
He says, he's approaching the stage. Yeah. What have you got there, sir? And, you know, he was in good humor about it, and I handed it up, and I gave the the obligatory line, we drove all the way from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dave, to give you this, your very own can of big-ass clams. And then the audience laughed, and he took it and showed it off. And I started to walk back to my seat, and he said, oh, here, come back here. And he got from one of the stagehands a can of big-ass ham. Turned out it was just, I think it was Krakus brand ham. It actually wasn't a big-ass brand. It wasn't even a doctored can, but I still cherish that can
That's
to this
so
day.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And in the show, this was May 5th, 1995, by the way, just in case you're keeping track.
Cinco de Mayo.
Cinco de Mayo. It was. There was a giant flying rat for Cinco de Mayo Day. must have made at least 10 or 12 references to the big-ass clams during the show. It really became the running gag of the show. And at one point, he promised the audience, Hootie and the Blowfish made either their first or second appearance on that show. And he said, you know, Paul, this band was originally known as Hootie and the Big-Ass Clams. And at one point, he said to the audience, okay, so we're going to show you this little piece here. Now, if you behave yourselves, we'll crack this can open and we'll pass around the big-ass clams. And at the end of it, while the piece was playing, we looked at the desk and here he was with a can opener opening the can of clams. At the end, he takes a spoonful himself and walks down to the audience and starts handing it around. I've got this video on my Facebook page. Yeah, it's very cool.
So May 5th, 1995.
May 5th, 1995.
Okay. All right.
You got to look it up.
I am going to.
And then, if I may.
What? There's more?
But 3 or 4 months later, I was a big, big late night, and still am, late night TV guy. And Tom Snyder was doing the Late Late Show at the time. And he was running this David Sanborn led theme song. And he was joking that, hey, if anybody's got any lyrics to go with it. And I thought, oh, God.
No pressure.
I said, no, don't even think about it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. And I'm crossing the McKay Bridge in Halifax one afternoon a couple days later. I thought, oh, I got an idea. Oh, shoot. I'm going to have to do it. And so back in 95, I had to go home, get the theme song put on cassette, go back to the radio station, put it on a reel-to-reel, lay my vocals down, put it in a package, take it to Pura later, and have it sent off. About 4 nights later on the Tom Snyder Late Late Show, he plays the... My theme song.
Can you sing it for us?
It's the Tomorrow Show without the Marlboros. Tom Snyder's back. Tom Snyder's on, and look at that. He's smoke-free. Perspiration drips from his upper lip. But gosh, Tom, great to have you back on Network TV. It was a bunch of inside jokes that he did. Okay. He had a lot of things about sweat meetings because of the perspiration on his lip and stuff. And they loved it. So there you go.
Look at that.
That's
right.
Your claim to fame. Never mind all this morning show business and breakfast TV. Jeez, come on.
This is true calling.
Oh my God.
He's like Bernie Taupin. Just yes.
It's much like Zelig, like we were discussing earlier. I kind of play whatever role matches the people around me.
You're multi-talented.
Honest to God. Why don't I make any money?
There you go. All right. Well, there's our catchphrase. Why didn't I make any money? Okay, let's end the show there. All right. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.